What's up, guys? Really grateful you guys are listening to the pod. I would love it if you could take just 5 seconds to leave a rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you might be listening to this. It really goes a long way to spread the message, which would allow me to get better guests to add more value to your life. And if you're one of the special people that have helped spread the word on this podcast, I am deeply appreciative of your support. Enjoy the episode. Is like the rate of people getting cancer higher?
Cancer rates are definitely getting younger.
Dr. Sanjay Juneja.
You likely know him as the Onc Doc.
A doctor, a hematologist, a social media personality.
In internal medicine, hematology, and oncology.
Doctor's got a podcast, been on a bunch of media outlets.
And he has a huge plan to help change how people view cancer.
Hey, everyone says, you know, relax, meditate, yoga. There's a reason. If you do intense exercise for 4 minutes a day, you have about an 18 to 20% less chance of having cancer. Not sleeping well. If you're hungover a lot, if you're like really poorly hydrated, that alone makes huge trajectory differences over 5 to 10 years.
In relation to supplements, like what are your thoughts on these longevity drugs?
I can say this much. By far the most common answer I've gotten back.
All right, Dr. Sanjay Juneja, thanks for coming on the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I'm excited. You have quite a lineup. Yeah. I don't know if I belong here.
No, you definitely do. You definitely do. I mean, we were just talking off that. I think it's going to be such a refreshing conversation, given that I think most people aren't super aware of all of the things around oncology. I actually didn't even know what oncology was until like 3 or 4 years ago when people in my life started to, you know, have inclinations of, you know, just with aging and so forth. And I think it's going to be a really refreshing conversation. So for people that don't actually know, what is a job of the oncologist and why should people be tuning in today?
Yeah. So oncology is basically, you know, the first question I get is like, when I'm a cancer doctor, a cancer specialist, they're like, oh, so you do research stuff. And that's all a whole different world, right? So what oncology is like is treating like when you have a cancer diagnosis, like what is the game plan? And a medical oncologist is that kind of, not even quarterback, either quarterback or coach, pick one and the patient's the other one. And you're kind of like basically balancing what the right way to treat something is, right? So we have breast cancers that are unfortunately like in such young people now, like early 30s and everything. And oftentimes curative if it's caught early enough. And so a medical oncologist is like, well, you don't necessarily need chemo or you do radiation first, surgery first and radiation. Basically an oncologist is treating both curative cancer. And then now people, you know, for the most part, even with that stage 4 scary term of like having like advanced cancer, I mean, people can live years depending on the tumor type, right? And not like just barely getting by, hair loss, vomiting, tied to an IV pole, not at all. I mean, you're walking around people all the time in the store that are just getting treatments every 3 to 4 weeks and they're like a year, year and a half out from their metastatic cancer. So as all this stuff gets more like novel and techy and not just your standard, you know, cytotoxic, kind of regarded as the poison chemo, which is kind of a factual statement. People are just living a lot longer, but you have to have somebody to manage that.
And are people coming in once they have detected it or have some inclination of it? Or do people come to you as a preventative measure? Maybe even someone that's just healthy that can just go through these routines with you?
Yeah. So for me, it's after diagnosis. So you have to like do med school residency in internal medicine and then a fellowship in oncology. So it takes forever. And so we are taught how to manage cancer, which is really kind of crappy if you think about it, because it's, we have a lot of people that are cured and they wonder like, okay, so what do I do next? And what do I do? And how do I eat? And it's like, oh, I don't know. You know, it's crazy that a cancer doctor doesn't really like have the education and the studies for that specifically. Now, one thing you can do if you got like a family history or you have things that look a little, you know, sketchy, if you've gotten your mammogram or whatever, and you want to see what your risk is, that's where like genetic counselors are super like key, because a lot of people, myself included, like ignorantly, I was like, oh, I got a 23andMe, so I know which genetics I have and which genetics I don't have for cancer, which is just not at all how that works. And really a genetic counselor, like there's a bunch of good ones on social media I've met, their kind of like test ordering kit and seeing them and interpreting it and see what you should be like getting screened to see if you, to make sure you don't have an early cancer. They're about the same price, like $250, $300. So if you're truly worried, or you had some, you know, sketchy-ish history, or you have a strong family history, I definitely would recommend one of those things. They're usually telly, but I have to make it absolutely clear because I've learned so much from social media, in a humbling way. Like one of the things that a lot of people think is like, oh, I don't have to worry about cancer. I don't have a family history, which is just couldn't be more backwards because honestly, unfortunately, you know, not even outside of pediatrics, anyone that gets cancer 85% of the time, it's due to an error that happened during your lifetime, 85 to 90%. Only 10 to 15% of cancers have any known genetic, like inherited predisposition to having cancer. So like most of it, 85-90%, are not any, that has nothing to do with some erroneous, you know, messed up mutation that you inherited. It's just stuff that happens in your lifetime.
Wow. And given that it's what, 10-15% of genetics, if your history of families have Alzheimer's or certain types, different types of cancer, what is the, there is certainly a higher likelihood, right? But you're saying it's not something that's going to be as important as taking care of your lifestyle, as making sure that you're healthy and all the, and so forth.
Yes and no. So like you totally nailed it. If you have one of those mutations, then yes, it's a whole different conversation. Like if you're in the group that has a known, you know, this is linked to early Alzheimer's. So late Alzheimer's isn't as genetic, right? But like early Alzheimer's, or like, you know, everyone's obsessed with this whole BRCA thing, and rightfully so, but it's a big thing on TV and all that stuff. Like, should I get double bilateral mastectomies and stuff? If you have a known thing, that's a whole different conversation that does merit, you know, a counselor and all that stuff. But for sure, we've learned that for the most part, when it comes to all of that, dementia stuff, cancer stuff, a lot of the genes, like they kind of lay the field to be able to have a predisposition, but there's no doubt that the way you live your life, diet and all this stuff like that we can get into, if interested, can actually have a huge bearing on whether or not that turns into what we call a phenotypic. So like you got genotypic, which means like this is the stuff you're inherited with. This is your deck of cards. These are your predispositions. And then phenotypic is like if you actually express, if that manifests into something relevant. So one example, my older son, my wife has blue eyes and we have like three boys. And like my older one, like actually had blue eyes for 7 months, right? Before the light kind of turned that melanin into dark brown. So genetically, he has a blue eye recessive trait because his were blue. And that's why little newborn's eyes are blue at first, because you got to get the melanin to show pigment. So that's the genotypic profile versus now phenotype. Now that he's lived in the sun and the exposure or whatever, his eyes are brown now because he was programmed with that. And that's the one that was selected for. So now when you have all this other predisposition stuff, you know, there is some merit to this whole concept of like not letting your sugars get crazy high. It's not necessarily binary. It's like, don't do sugars, it's terrible. But really, like, and I think you had Jason Fung, to his point, if nobody's seen it, is if they're just persistently high, and then now you have this insulin coming out all the time, which guess what? Insulin's a growth factor. It literally stands for growth factor. Well, what is cancer? Unregulated cell growth. So if you have people that are just like getting whipped with growth factor, growth factor, growth factor to bring the sugars down, they're going to have like, and that's why every time when you look at cardiovascular risk, obesity, lack of exercise, and cancer, those lines always match up together, because it's like you're just pumping through with growth factor and telling your body to store all these calories. And we know fat, you know, to a degree causes inflammation. I'm not somebody like, I'm overweight some months and underweight. I wish it wasn't the case, but it all matters. And I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that it does. But just don't, you know, I always say just don't go crazy with anything, right? Because you've got to live life. And I see, you know, as an oncologist, people younger than me, 30, 35, that's about my age, you know, dying of cancer and like, and super healthy. And so it's just a very humbling reminder to like everything in moderation balance. Are you happy with yourself, with what you're doing? Are you reasonable? Those are things that are just overlyingly the most important more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, this again, for a lot of people listening, I don't know how much they actually understand about cancer, mainly because it's just not something most people have to think about. This really hit home for me a couple of years, maybe a year ago, really, where I had a good friend of mine where we were living in the same city and we moved apart because we both lived in different cities after that. And she had breast cancer. She's I'm 30 right now, so she's probably around my age. And that's really when things hit home for you, when someone in your circle is facing, in your, you know, demographic, someone that's your age, someone that you were just hanging out with. And I was, you know, really shocked at this. A lot of our friend group was, without really even understanding what is that was really going on behind the scenes. So what is, you know, if you can just kind of give us a Cancer for Dummies summary of what is actually happening in our bodies when we have cancer. I saw someone, a friend of mine that was super healthy, and now she has, you know, this tumor that's growing in her breast. She has breast cancer. What is like the quick summary of what's actually happening on a biological level?
Yeah. So cancer, and this is what makes it so hard to treat, right, is cancer is unregulated cell growth. So our bodies, you'll keep hearing me say we're just a bunch of ingrates. We're ingrates because of the body is it's ridiculously complicated and dynamically doing things minute to minute all the time in so many levels that I've absolutely actually overwhelm you if you thought about how many things are happening at once. Part of that thing, those things, is the fact that our cells like have a life. They die and they grow, and then basically they all have like a half-life or a life or duration. The easiest way to appreciate that is dust, right? Dust is your skin and your hair. And you're like, well, what is it? It's one of those interesting facts. It's actually skin and hair, the dust in your house. Because things turn over and then they shed and you're making new ones. And that applies to everything. Like when people say like, well, I'm not pooping because I'm not eating. I'm like, no, like all that stuff in your intestine is shedding. All those, the inside wall die, they have a life, and then they shed and you poop them out and then you make new ones. And that happens to everything. Your lung tissue, you know, other than your brain and spinal cord after age of five, everything has a duration of life. So like a red blood cell lasts like, you know, 120 days. So what's happening is the reason that cancer is a diagnosis of age more than anything else, most people that get cancer by far are over 50 and over 65. Why? Why is that? It's because as these things duplicate over time, our bodies are wickedly good at recognizing when there was an error in the stamp. You know, when you're stamping the holiday cards and like the ink's starting to fade and everyone has a different threshold of how much fade in the ink on the stamp am I willing to withhold before doing more ink, right? So I probably let it go a little too far. But our cells say like they want precision. They want the stamp to not have a single faded part in it. And they're doing this constantly. So much so that we have 10,000 errors a day, bro. 10,000 a day that our immune system constantly is like, kill, 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 messed up, scrap it, scrap it, scrap it. It's like those Netflix documentaries where you mess up one thing, you know, on the cooking shows and they're like, we can't serve that. That's what's happening all the time. But what happens is sometimes, and over time, it's just statistical likelihood, that cell ends up having an error that went undetected. And guess what? As it's growing, that one error is like now like a part of that entire population. It may not be cancer, but say you have to get to home base. It might be the first step that, and then you got to get to second and third. And then during that time when they all have that first base error, at some point, one person will get an error that now gets the second base growth. And then say a third base growth, and now it's considered cancerous. Why? Because it means that it is now unregulated. It doesn't just stay and die like it's supposed to, but it's actually doing things it's not supposed to. Like it'll recruit blood vessels. It thinks it's alone. Really, some people would almost pity it because it's like the cancer just at that point believes it has to do everything it needs to survive. And it was your cell. So it uses all the mechanisms that your own body inherently has to survive. But the key is it escaped your immune system. And that's why there's all this obsession, and too much, I think, when it says about like your immune therapy, buy these $100 vitamins, it boosts your immune. That's not always a good thing. But it's true, the fact that your immune system is what saves us. Like when people had HIV and AIDS, it's like we learned so much about cancer. They had full-blown cancers we'd never seen ever and described before. Because they're with AIDS, your like lymphocytes are shot. And that's why so many of our drugs now go back to like re-enabling the immune system. You can cure somebody with melanoma, stage four everywhere now with immune therapy, which basically allows your immune cells to find the melanoma. And there's a percentage, I think it's still single digits, that are just alive and no detectable disease. So retraining the immune system or making it smarter to do what it do, like it always has done, that's the modern therapy. But that's what cancer is. It's just an error. And how do you invite errors? Tobacco use, right? Smoking. It causes like an inflammation and aggravation in the lung tissue. And you piss it out. You piss out all those chemicals. People that have a bunch of exposures and live in polluted areas, they have a little bit more bladder cancer and colorectal because you're inhaling it. And so it's like, it's just all of these things that invite mutations that can then catalyze one cell to 2 to 10 to 100. And you need about 100 million to see it on a scan, like 100 to 200 million in one place to see it on a CT. Like if you could see it at 100, it'd be Gucci. Like we'd be good. Like if you could just hone a missile in and go kill it at that time, great. But if you can't, and you're waiting for a big enough size, that's where usually taking that thing out and liberally taking it out so you have all, it's encapsulated in all good tissue, you're like, I hope I got it all. Because in that case, hopefully it hasn't gone anywhere else.
So let's talk about that is we don't want people to detect it too late. And I know people my age, you know, people aren't even doing blood work. I mean, most people don't really think about these long-term effects of their health when they're in their 20s or 30s. And from what you just said was 100 million for it to be detected on a scan. I mean, for someone that's my age, what are some of the things that we should look out for that would allow us to detect something like this? I understand like lumps are like a big thing, but like beyond that, like what are some of the other checkups or signals that we should be listening to our bodies to potentially detect it?
Clue it in, yeah. I mean, I think at a bare minimum, it's very important. Sorry, a train comes by at this time every time. But at a bare minimum, you want to get your blood count annually because if you have any kind of insurance, it's covered. And by blood work, you mean just like complete blood count and CMP or chemistries, which is your liver and kidney function. The reason that's important, and please, anyone listening to this, if you are somebody, you know, a female that has cycles, then maybe you'll be iron deficient or anemic, right? So like your blood level is low. And hopefully that's the only reason. But if you're not having cycles or having any blood loss, a big one that you'll see, I have millions of views on a few of those videos on TikTok, is where I'm like, bro, it is never normal to just all of a sudden get iron deficient. Like if you're anemic and you weren't anemic, meaning like a low blood level, and you find out the iron's low, you got to be like, where's the blood loss, right? Because that could be an early tumor, like in your colon or in your stomach. Again, if you're having cycles every month, then you know where you're losing the blood because blood is made up of iron. But something as simple as that is important. So you just want to get the complete blood count for number one. And number two, your chemistries. But short of that, if you have a mass in general, cancers don't come and go. If that thing fades, it's unlikely that it's a cancer. But if it stays, and it's not, usually cancers aren't tender. They're not hot, they're not angry, they're not inflamed. Why? Because that's all stuff that your immune cells taking care of something. They're usually just, there's not much inflammation and it's rock hard. That's something you want to check, right? And the main thing is you want to get your screening. And there isn't a lot at a young, early age, for the most part, other than like colonoscopies and mammogram, depending on your family history, is about 40 to 45. That's the whole point of screening. It's like, let's take a look. Like, let's take a dedicated image and they get paid for. But Sean, if you want to hear something absolutely terrifying, and I just found this out on my own podcast with a guest I had that does pediatric cancers. If you are 25 years old and you have the same apples to apples cancer, same circumstances, same term, same blueprint of the cancer, everything, you will do worse in survival than a 60-year-old with the same thing and a 17-year-old with the same thing. And you might say, what? Sanjay, why? That's like the healthiest prime age. Unfortunately, more or less, it all comes down to money. But it's because of like, one, people don't get checked to their routine stuff. Number two, and the main thing is they're not insured. They can write out, you know, I did till 26 with their parents' insurance, or they're uninsured and they don't go to the doctor enough. There's no other reason. And also sometimes there's a ping ponging back and forth, but there's no other reason than not because of their health, but because of just either checking in or not being able to have it covered. It's awful. Right now, people that are adolescents and young adults, compared to the survivals of pediatrics and adults, do worse than they did in 1975. That's scary. You look at the difference, and it's 2.23. And even though we cure pediatric because everyone's insured, it's awful. So I go to DC semi-often just to work on the policy stuff. But pediatrics is the one place we might cure cancer forever. It's like 85-90% cure rate, regardless of what cancer you have in the peds population.
Wow.
Not regardless, wow, but overall, if you take them all put together.
So going back to, for a lot of young people that are just doing blood work, is that the main thing to look out for based on the biomarkers and like correlation of cancer that we have the deficiency of iron?
That's a great question. That's one very minute like tip off, right? But if your liver numbers are like coming up or showing distress, like that's something that you wouldn't know, right? That's the thing. When something is early, you really don't know because it's not systemic yet. That's not in other places. Mm. Nobody should be listening to this and freaking out. Like if you look at the numbers, just Google it. It's just not common. But the things you do want to know about is, are my liver numbers good? At least there's some okay, I feel pretty good about that, right? And if your CBC is good, you feel good about that, your complete blood count. The main things where something is not right, or at least make sure it's not something scarier, is if you have persistent like appetite loss, like your hunger is just gone and you're losing weight and you don't know why. Or you have drenching night sweats, like truly drenching, fevers. You know, I'm going to say subjective fatigue, but we all have fatigue. We're all, you know, if we're in our 20s and 30s, we're the most stressed out generation. And I agree, right? I feel that way. But there's fatigue. But yeah, you're losing weight for no reason. You have drenching night sweats. You just have what's called lethargy or just pronounced fatigue. Get a blood count, bro. Like that's where I'm just like, you got to get your blood count because that even shows a little bit of your nutrition labs. And if you have like a systemic cancer, your nutrition labs start falling too. So again, nobody, I don't want to freak out anybody about this. Cancer is so much better treatable now than it's ever been. But at the bare minimum, get that done, you know, make sure you're not losing weight. And for the most part, statistically, you're fine.
Yeah. No, I think the idea here is certainly to get people to be just more aware of it, because I'm thinking about all the symptoms you mentioned around night sweats or appetite loss. And I know most people that are my age, the first thing they're thinking is not that they have cancer potentially, right? They might just be thinking that their hormones are out of imbalance or they're stressed out, or it's like cancer, I think, is probably the last thing on their list, when, especially if they were to get blood work. So it seems like it's, even if something was off, it's not the first thing that they would really think about. But if they were to have suspicions around it, what would the next step be? Like an MRI? Would it be like an X? Like what's kind of the next scanning process that you recommend people to take?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, the main thing is, remember, is the persistence. So it's like if you're having these low-grade fevers at night and you're having drenching night sweats, or just like, you know, change in bowel movements that are just never going back to normal, and these things are going on more than 10 to 14 days, then that's when you're like, well, how could this be a virus or an illness? It's been going on for 3 weeks, you know, 3 or 4. Mm. That's the tip off, because cancer doesn't wax and wane. It just continues to do the problem. But as far as the scan and all that, that definitely matters on what the cancer is, right? We have hundreds. So you go to your primary doctor. If you don't feel good or heard, you know, I think it's important to if you don't feel right about the thoroughness of the evaluation, go to another doctor. Like, it's your body. You have the right to do that. But if you give a good history and you get some explanation for why this may be going on, hopefully some lab work or testing to corroborate, that would be a really good place to start. If you don't get a good explanation, that's where I think like the bare minimum, then at some point the blood work should be done, just in general, like your CBC, CMP, which is your liver stuff, kidney stuff, blood count. And then depending on what your symptom is, like if you're like coughing up blood, then obviously you need a chest x-ray. Or if you're noticing your urine is continuously pink or ruddy, then you worry that you're, you know, peeing blood. It's like a kidney mass kind of thing. Again, I really hope I'm not gaslighting by saying all this. It's just that, but these are realities that you know, the reassurance alone is nice, but on top of that, there are things that usually are an issue that go on, you know, for multiple weeks or just doesn't relent. I think it's a good, you know, it's always good to know for sure, like to pinpoint and say, what is it? Like, you shouldn't have drenching night sweats, like with some hormone imbalance, right? Like, it needs to be pretty, you know, significant, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And you're saying that'll be consistent. It's not just going to be something that goes in and out.
So
if it's consistent for over weeks,
yeah,
then check it out.
Exactly.
Got it.
Like, cause like cancer doesn't just like spontaneously revert. Your inflammation does, your, you know, all those things do, hormone levels, all that stuff is dynamic. And this, but not like cancer that's just unregulated cell growth. It doesn't usually just like have periods of being indolent and then coming back and periods of indolent.
Sure.
It's always more like infectious or, you know, that kind of stuff. Autoimmune.
Yeah. Talk to me about the rate of cancer. Like, is it me or is like the rate of people getting cancer higher, even for people that are younger age?
Yeah.
Or is it just that people are living longer? Like, what's kind of your...
No.
Is there any studies around this?
Yeah, cancer's... I don't specialize in it, but from, you know, my podcast stuff, I'm having to look this up all the time. And cancer rates are definitely getting younger. Now, there's some suspicion that it's... that in part, at least, because we just suspect it, you know, more. Like, the screening's better. People are more aware.
Right.
The detection can be at an earlier time. But I think few can argue that colorectal, liver cancer, biliary cancer, it's kind of weird stuff. Even breast, like, it's definitely seems to be more and earlier. And the big thought is, you know, that's where you distill everything else. So, like, okay, what's different? What's different from now compared to 50 years ago, 100 years ago? Why? Like, we already established it's not, if it's genetic, it would just be the same logarithmic, or not logarithmic, the same linear growth, right? But it's not. So you got to say, obviously, it's something more than that. And by far, the thought is, if you look at the concordance of, you know, childhood obesity and obesity in general and insulin requirements and crazy high sugars, you'll notice that that line often matches the same, like, subgroup in cancers that go up, you know, kind of to that same degree. And the reason being, too, is when you look at a lot of places in the world that don't have the convenience, and don't get me wrong, like, I love the Mexican pizza from Taco Bell. That's why I'm not saying that I'm, like, healthy by any means. I need to be healthier. But the truth is, with the convenience, or countries that don't have the convenience of the Mexican pizza, Taco Bell, like, hot and spicy's at McDonald's, all this stuff is such a jolt. It's not so much... It is also the how often, but it's that it's such a large amount for your body to handle that compared to the stuff that when we were nomadic and had to, like, you know, chop off at the stalk of things and figure out how to get, you know, choose from celery and all this stuff. Like, our bodies are equipped to do a lot with a little. And now we have a whole lot when it comes to one meal. And then it causes a lot of this metabolic inflammatory storage stuff that just says, where do I put it? You know, that's why obesity, that's why you're seeing fatty liver disease now. That's terrifying. When you have fatty liver disease, if you don't do something about it over 10, 15 years, like, it scars over and you get cirrhosis, like people with liver disease. And, like, I have a lot of 30 and 40 year olds that come in for just a little bit of a low platelet, which you wouldn't know, right? Unless you were getting a complete blood count. Platelets help you clot. And I always get an abdominal ultrasound because I want to catch early liver disease. That seems to be way more often. So that when I tell them about it, they fix it. I mean, it's like amazing. I'm like, do intermittent fasting if you can, like, you know, pulse your workouts, not the steady state stuff. And so anyone hearing all this, instead of being freaked out, just a little bit of education, just knowing where you're at and slight modifications, like, huge difference on your cancer risk and all these issues I'm talking about over the next 5 or 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. Like, that's the takeaway. It's like, do I want to be scared and freak out about this every 4 weeks, every 3 weeks? You can. I do sometimes. Or I could say every 3 to 4 weeks and be like, oh, this is what I'm doing to make sure that this doesn't become a problem. But you got to break that steel. You got to at least say, like, am I just going to do some low level, you know, about taking to just make sure that I can say, then whatever happens, happens, but that I did something to try to avoid what seems to be a trend when it comes to cancers being diagnosed at a younger age.
Yeah, that's really helpful there. I was reading Outlive by Peter Attia, who I really follow around the ideas of longevity. And he talks about how in kind of entering the 1900s, our life expectancy on average was around 50 because of the plague and all of these diseases that we have that we didn't really know how to cure back then. And the way our medical system really was structured was based on fast cures, I guess that you should say, versus more of the proactive preventative approach that most people today are really trying to advocate. But that education and that process isn't really built in for most people today. And we're kind of relying on the pharmacology industry and all these things. And I think this is really, this part of the interview, I think is really going to be most helpful for people because, like we said, most people are relatively healthy, they're young, but we really want to encourage that preventative and proactive approach. So to kind of go deeper into what are some of the choices that people can be making today, or lack of choices, what are some of these lifestyle choices that we're mostly making today on a common on a frequent basis that are probably going to be, you know, likely to cause us cancer down the road?
Yeah, I mean, there was a study I've done, had to do a couple of interviews this week about if you do intense exercise for 4 minutes a day, you have about an 18 to 20% less chance of having cancer in the future than somebody that doesn't like do exercise, you know, to a high degree. So when people say like, oh, workout, exercise, diet, exercise, let's be very clear. It's the healthcare system's fault that we don't know what we're doing. It's like, it's so blanketed, the statements, nothing is structured to be able to give you counsel on, like, for the most part. Now, there are good doctors that just do it, but it's not, there's not even a billable thing for the most part in traditional practice in a community that says, like, I did education on this, that, and the other, right? Like, it's more reactive, like you said. Oh, you have diabetes now, probably could have avoided it, but they'll say that, or, you know, or you were never educated to, and then we treat. So the things that matter is that strenuous activity, even the 4 minutes a day, like that makes a huge difference, not just for cancer, but like stroke, even they say like dementia, like, you know, neurologic disease, heart attacks, all of that, just get your heart rate up. Like I used to do like fitness, personal health stuff in residency, and I would always say, I would much rather you, if you're running for an hour and a half, 2 days a week, I would much rather you spend like 10 minutes going up and down the stairs and getting that heart rate up to about 150, 160, especially if you could do 10 minutes like four times a day. That 40 minutes, but doing it every day or every other day, is so much more than that 90 minutes, you know, debatably, but that hour and a half, that 90 minutes, 180 minutes between the two, just for 2 days a week. It's the regularity of your body being pushed to like use its glucose mobilization better, use its like metabolic stuff better. That heart rate clears your lymphedema and those toxins that build up. That's what lymph fluid is. It like clears and flushes it out. You want to innervate your parasympathetic system, which is the opposite of your stress system, which is adrenaline and sympathetic. And that's why everyone says, like, you know, relax, meditate, yoga. There's a reason. Take cold showers. All of that stuff directly goes against the stressful sympathetic stuff. So if you don't sleep, if you like, or when I say stress, it's not necessarily mental. I mean like physiologic. If you're not sleeping well, if you're hungover a lot, if you're like really poorly hydrated, all of these things raise your sympathetic, adrenergic, adrenaline thing. And that does, we know that correlates with increased heart attack, stroke, cancers, glucose dysregulation. Good sleep, parasympathetic engagement. That's why I take cold showers. I hate cold showers. I take it hot first. But even being under cold water engages your vagal zen, you know, system. Exercise does that, and then a whole bunch of other things. So that's why that's a big piece. Secondly, thirdly, whatever number we're on, it's fine, in my personal opinion, that if people, including myself, like have a decadent meal, have like, you know, whatever. I shouldn't say that even alcohol, but alcohol is something that in the South we do a lot of, but it is definitely a category one, like association with cancer, like at all. But it's hard to, that doesn't mean necessarily that everyone has to remove it, but without a doubt, it is directly linked to multiple cancers. But my point in saying all of that is it's like the moderation, right? Like it's just think, am I eating fast food most days a week? Like if you are, and you look at that thing and you look at the, like, it's not about the weight gain. It's not about what you look like, but just the amount of stress you put on your body, having to ingest and break that down. If you're doing that regularly, that's a whole different conversation over 5 years than most of the time. You're just good with like eating a whole bunch of fruits, you know, and vegetables and like, and those kind of things that are just like not that big insult. That alone makes huge trajectory differences over 5 to 10 years. On cancer, heart disease, all that kind of stuff.
Can you talk a little bit about, because this really concept of like hot and cold and extra like stressing our bodies and not stressing our bodies, that really hit home for me when I understood this concept of hormesis, where like that small stress that really benefits our bodies. And maybe that can help really help people at a higher level understand why small stresses are good for our bodies. And instead of like really learning the tactic, understanding the whole reason behind it, could you just kind of give us a, like a very summary of hormesis and what that does?
So when I say stressed bodies with the pulse rate, I don't consider that like the stress that I meant. Like that meant more like, they say strenuous. So let's use the word strenuous for that. This pulse, these pulsed strenuous activities of getting your heart rate to 150, 170, that is a healthy mechanism of doing things because it adapts your, it doesn't let your body get lazy. And I don't mean even right then. I mean, even physiologically, like what your glucagon has to do to mobilize the sugar to make sure you're keeping up with it. It's basically like getting an oil change. And so everything's put into check. You basically recruit some good inflammation. I told you, like immune cells, which obviously cause inflammation, like that's like a good like police cop, right? For like cancers and stuff. Mm-hmm. It kind of jogs it up. If you're doing the stairs and you're 10 flights, you're huffing and puffing, you might start sweating. That jars everything up and causes this nice like constant just check. Like, do you know how you say like just put them in check or do a check every now and then? If you're doing that multiple times a week or let alone multiple times a day, you're getting to recycle everything, liberate your like your toxins. You're getting your immune system to have to kind of wake up and get, you know, get off the bench. Versus imagine your heart rate is always chilling. You're just always in a chilling like position. That's a whole different level of inertness. So that in that strenuous capacity is a little different than the whole concept on a high level of sympathetic and parasympathetic. Those are like the Greek mythology. It's always one or the other. Like sympathetic, and they're stuck. It's like they're like married in Greek mythology forever. And people have a lot of sympathetic, which is the not in any word to mean sympathy. It means that it's adrenaline system, and that's increased cortisol, increased physiologic stress, increased. It is a constant state of physiologic stress. That's the stuff that you're supposed to tap into to run away from something scary, or if you're like giving a speech. But if you don't sleep 8 hours a day, if you drink and if you're hungover, all of these things balance it way more on the adrenaline constant versus the parasympathetic, which is the calmness, the peaceness, like less of the bad inflammation. And that peaceness is the whole concept of meditation, what happens after the strenuous exercise and even during. That's actually some more in some way vagal parasympathetic stuff. Good sleep is ridiculously important. All these men are getting put on like testosterone and stuff, and I find out like they have sleep apnea or they're just not sleeping well. They're like snoring really bad. They haven't been tested. Decreased libido, like depression, like increased chance of glucose, can't take weight off. Those are all side effects of even just poor sleep, like alone. So anything to reduce your physiologic stress and bring that parasympathetic up, including cold showers, that engages your vagal system. I don't have much time. Like I'm reevaluating my life to figure out how to get kind of more TLC and care for myself. But the one thing I can do is I have to shower every day, so I make it cold. So like it's vagal, you know? I try to like palliate myself during my drive. I'm like, that's a time when I can check in volitionally into my parasympathetic, chill out, temper that like sympathetic adrenaline overdrive down. It's not just psychological, it's physiologic. And they have very profound effects on long-term health. That's why when you look at studies with like people that live in, you know, collaborative arrangements, like in the Danish area, Netherlands, you look at all these different lifestyles and you figure out how are these people living so alive and well for a long time. You look at their diet, you look at this, that, and the other. The places that just move slower and like have a lot of like more of that social, you know, aspect of unwinding and everything, they generally have less cancers and heart disease than our country, for example, where it's just high pressure system.
Yeah, I think I've heard like Okinawa, which is one of the blue zones, they have even like a word for it called Moai, I think, where it's a group of small community, a lot of women, but it's generally like small communities of people that are constantly meeting and catching up and communicating. And it's just this tight group of friend circles. And certainly they attribute a lot of that to how people live so long as well, which isn't like the first thing you think about, right? Most people think about what they ingest, you know, how they live and all that stuff, but not necessarily the emotional side of things.
Yeah. And it has a big play. And that's why when you look at the people that started the wineries in Napa, we know it's unquestionable that alcohol causes cancer and also sun and all this stuff. And yet you hear about all the stories that found the wineries, even back then they were living to 80 or 90. And we're like, how, why? And really one of the main thoughts is just slowed down, less adrenergic, less sympathetic system, whole lot more parasympathetic. And that actually goes back to the full, you know, full circle to what you asked way earlier is, okay, if you're born with something or inherited, is it still like, you know, somehow influenced by what you do in your lifetime? Clearly, because you can even take risks, you know, risks with like certain habits. You have 90-year-olds that live to in their 90s that smoke. Sorry, you have longtime smokers that live to their 90s and stuff. So there's it's a shuffle deck, and making micro changes is so much, I think it can have so much of a drastic outcome on your day-to-day health, you know, just years down the road. And they're minor. They're just things you got to think about. You got to channel, you got to check yourself in and say, you know, week to week, just look back for 7 days and be like, could I have done more of this? Like just chilled or, you know, slept better or whatever that thing is.
At a high level, if you were to advise a diet or certain types of foods that we should be eating regularly or avoiding, to, you know, to really minimize the chances of us getting cancer, what does that look like for you?
For sure, the thing that seems to matter in general with, because remember, there's so many different types of cancer. So it's like even blood cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, which this may not apply to, you know, which seems way less diet related as opposed to like breast cancer and colon cancer. But for sure, like, it seems when we look at different populations in the world, having like a low glycemic diet, and somebody might be like, what does that mean? It's like when they say, when they introduced white bread, like the cheap white bread that we all ate when we were younger, I don't know, at least we did, I was public school raised. But when you have these fast burning sugars and high glycemic index, meaning how friable are these sugars, for lack of a better term, it's what fast food is like packed with. Having a lot of that is definitely seems to be associated and see spikes in those demographics, so socioeconomic demographics that eat those kind of products, the fast burning sugars, the honey buns, all that stuff, has a much higher seemingly like incidence of cancer, as well as obviously glucose dysregulation. So people that are low glycemic, so when you have more like fibrous hearty stuff, the fruits, the vegetables, some people think that means just eat a bunch of meats. It doesn't necessarily mean that, but granolas, like nuts, things that are not so high on those fast burning sugars and classic carbs, that in and of itself, like if you can make a heterogeneous diet of the other things, has a big consequence, it seems, on your chances of getting cancer. It really does. Like it's not, don't necessarily have to go keto or anything like that, but at least have a low glycemic index. Just beef up on all the other things. And another thing that they came out recently in the last year or so is having just a heterogeneous diet in general, meaning like you'll eat that weird fruit or, you know, that thing you've never heard of, having this like really dynamic mixed introduction of stuff on your gut microbiome, which is a whole nother podcast in itself. But your gut microbiome and immunity, as Peter Attia and Z-Dog and a bunch of people talk about often, it definitely has downstream consequences on what? Your immune system, which I told you is what? Important for cancer. That's where that whole cycle happens. It's like gut microbiome trained or overtrained or undertrained. For autoimmune disease, it's overtrained, meaning they're too active. But that interplay of autoimmune disease and cancer seem to have a big relation to what's happening in the gut. And how do you take care of your gut? Is to like make sure that it's like it's you know, introduced with the things that, me personally, everything that's natural in life. Like, how do we evolve to get here? What were our diets? We had selection pressure to be the way we are. Circumstances where you're nomadic and walking around and you know, you don't have fast food. The things that align with that, just, you know, sensibly, probably have the best outcomes for longevity, right? Which is why the fruits, the vegetables, the nuts, the berries, the things you can eat, try not to be that picky eater that says, I don't like that, I haven't tried that, or I've never heard of it, or that looks gross. If you're having a uniform, narrow diet, your poor little microbiome is just not that, it's not that conditioned. Like, it's not that like adaptive, and it doesn't kind of like introduce your immune system to all different kind of things that are good and bad and everything else, because you're just so narrow. So that even seems to have a big play.
Interesting. So is it fair to summarize that it's like low sugar, low carbs at a high level, and try to diversify within those categories of food as much as you can.
You got it. Yeah.
Is that the idea?
That's what I think most people, if you had to poll in bar graphs, you would see most people would recommend that are in the cancer space. I personally love intermittent fasting, and it's not that hard. I just mean like 16 hours. It's the modified. So it's like if you stop eating at 8 p.m., you don't put in calories till noon. You can still have your black coffee. Mm. It's not that many calories, right? You can still hydrate and everything. But having little, it's the same concept of pulsed exercise. On the flip side, having these times of where your body just has to figure out what to do and mobilize its fat and calories and kind of adapt to the fact that it's not getting food all the time, that can have big downstream consequences, some literature shows. So if you could do that just a couple times a day, just like 8 p.m. tomorrow, I'm going to make it till noon. I got a busy morning anyway. And a lot of people are like, I almost do that. I eat a bagel though in the morning, or I eat a breakfast bar. You've just crushed it. You just like reset the fast. You already got hopefully those 8 hours, if you're able to sleep 8 hours of the fast over your sleep. So now just get to 16, just get through the 8 hours in the morning. And that can actually lead to lean muscle mass, better glucose control, everything.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview again with Peter Thiel, and he was talking about how he was an aggressive faster. He would do 7-10 day water fast, all in the hopes of, obviously reducing cancer risks and so forth. And he talks about it in a recent interview where he stopped intermittent fasting because he basically said that there wasn't really enough data to support that fasting, what fasting was doing at a cellular level. And he saw the downsides of losing muscle mass. And he obviously reverted back and said that like if he was to be at stage 1 to 4 cancer and have a tumor, he would go back to fasting. But for most people that are living their regular lives, he just mentioned that these aggressive fastings, at least like these 3-5-7 day fast, was just not sustainable for him. Well, what are your thoughts on like fasting
I mean, you're talking to someone who's never made it like 2 or 3 days. Like, so,
it's tough.
Yeah. It's the same concept. You want to put stress in the good sense if you can to try to see the benefits, but he's exactly right. Hasn't been justified yet on a cellular level. The reason I like the intermittent is if nothing else, because there's some debate that's like, oh, it's not really doing anything. It's not getting you to keto or any of that. So why do it? It's not long enough. You got to get to 24 or 36 hours. But if nothing else, it's the window of time that you're putting in less calories because we eat way more than we realize, right? And that in itself is considered healthy. I try to push my 16 window to 18 hours if I can. But these prolonged fasts, like it is debated to a degree. I've always wanted to experience keto because I just keep hearing from everyone. And it makes sense on a level that apparently like locks you in with your focus. And the thought is in evolution, back when we were nomadic, if you haven't eaten in 36, 40 hours, you would think with evolution and natural selection, something had to happen in your body physiologically, almost as a jump ship, to make sure you were able to find food. So they say that process of that ketosis and what it does, like in circulation to your body, apparently is like the cleanest locked in blue pill feeling. That's why they say that, is because it does at least make sense, the theory, on like you have to get into a state of the bottleneck, the people that had the mutations to get into a heightened state rather than a weaker state on getting no intake or food, they're the ones that would most likely survive, right? So that's where the whole concept comes in of like, is there this next level that gets into ketosis? I have patients that tell me before they do a big national talk, they make sure to get into ketosis so that they're just on it. So I'm here, yes, just turned 36 to experience it myself. Now, there are things that you can buy to give you a temporary ketosis, apparently. Hmm. I haven't tried them, but you can actually, like, they're on Amazon and stuff. Obviously, you got to figure out what it is. I've been holding off, but apparently you take it and it puts you into ketosis temporarily for 2 to 4 hours.
Is that like ketones that you're buying so that your body's just ingesting more?
No, it actually, like, I think it binds up. It basically induces a ketosis. So it's a temporary hold to where you're not making those high levels. basically you're actually going into ketosis, but it's temporary. And then when that, I guess, I don't know if it's an enzyme blocker or whatever, I'm not sure what the mechanism is, but you stay in it for a brief period of time.
Yeah. Kind of in relation to supplements, like what are your thoughts on these longevity drugs that are being promoted and taken? You know, I think Dr. David Sinclair talks about taking like metformin, which was originally for diabetes, but it's helpful for longevity. There's like MNN, NAD, all these different acronyms that are coming out, but it's still in the early stages. But what are your thoughts on that for like cancer prevention or longevity in general?
So the one thing I have to be safe and tell you, just being a traditional doctor, I can say this much. When I have on my podcast, I have a bunch of, you know, cancer gurus, right? Like it's like Pulitzer Prize winners, Harvard, Hopkins, just whoever, directors that are crazy in their field. And when I finish the Riverside thing, I always hit stop. So I don't have to tell them like, wait till it finishes uploading. And then, you know, I don't have to say all that. I just stop it. So then it's all loaded. And we have, you know, small talk. And I ask that question. And by far, I'm just going to say this, take it for what you will. By far, the most common answer I've gotten back when they give me two or three names is metformin. So I'm just going to leave you with that. So like, it's not the data to show it, but that of all the experts that I have on my show, this is the one that I've heard the most commonly. Now, the other stuff I have to leave to the experts because in a similar fashion, we actually have very little training. It's all on my sub-interest. There's some great creators on TikTok that are like PhD nerds and just super into it that I can, you know, share if you want to kind of put on the bottom of your thing, because it's very interesting to me. But I am traditionally a data-driven person, just in virtue of, especially in cancer, you have to be. But yeah, so that's my
point. What is it about metformin? I mean, it's meant for diabetes. So I guess you can just talk about what it's actually doing for our bodies and how it could potentially be helpful for preventing cancer.
It actually, coincidentally enough, goes back to everything we were just talking about. Like it helps you with your glucose regulation. So there's like, there's something there with when you get exposed to high levels of glucose and what you're having to do either to correct it or the worst case, you can't correct it. All diabetes is, type 2 diabetes, by the way, is you're not able to adequately correct the amount of sugar you're putting into your body. That's all type 2 diabetes is. It's like, it's not this crazy complicated thing. It's just that eventually, and the thought is you've stored so much fat or you've been on, you know, on 6,000 RPMs and that gear for so long and there's no gear higher that like basically the sugars just get higher and you're doing the best you can to get it down. You can't. So metformin helps that process as well. The glucose regulation, intermittent fasting, glucose regulation, high intensity exercise rather than steady state, high burst of like glucose regulation. So all the things we talked about, I think not coincidentally, have to go back to not just avoiding diabetes, but how often do you subject yourself to these high saturated, you know, ingestions of these like these bad sugars and carbs and fast burning, you know, things. It's just no coincidence in my mind, I think, that it all relates back to that. And metformin is in a similar fashion.
And are you able to prescribe metformin to clients of yours that are dealing not with diabetes, but with potential cancer risks?
So metformin I have to say it's pre-diabetes. So like you actually don't have to be diabetes yet. You can get on metformin with your primary doctor, even if you're pre. So you don't have the A1C of how sweet your red blood cell is. That's what an A1C is. You don't have to be full diabetic. There are plenty of more modern, I don't want to call them concierge, but cancer, I can't call them facilities, but basically like cancer treatment adjuncts, and even people that are out on their own private practice that do incorporate metformin. I actually am a consultant with one company that's actually looking to see what that metformin difference does even on fruit flies that have cancer because of all the interest. But traditionally, like we use, if we're practicing, you know, traditional oncology medicine, we use NCCN guidelines, and it's not yet shown a statistical significance or been studied yet closely enough to actually add it. Without deviating a little bit from the standard of care guidelines. That doesn't mean, that's this very boring, unsexy doctor answer. That doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing. Doesn't mean I should be or shouldn't be doing it. It's just that we need an episode on just the healthcare system in general, because that's a lot.
No, I get it. Yeah. You want to be,
But that's where these podcasts help. That's why I have mine. Like, I practice traditional oncology, but I want nutrition experts and I want people that are into that stuff, because at the end of the day, like every patient and every person listening to this is in charge of their health. Like they shouldn't follow the rules if they are counterproductive, you know?
Sure.
So we got to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, just to have that information out there for people to make their own informed decisions, I think is really the whole purpose of it, right? Of conversations like this. Just kind of close off in terms of the treatments that you recommend. So going back full circle to a friend of mine, she's actually choosing not to go the traditional route, I guess you can say, with chemotherapy and more invasive processes. And she's trying to go more of the alternative approach. So is that a common thing these days? Is that something you recommend? And what are some of the alternative approaches that are not as invasive as chemo that have actually proven to work?
So, and of course I have my own, you know, bias, but yes. If it's a curative cancer, what I would tell you to ask your oncologist is, what is the chances of achieving a permanent remission or a cure with whatever is proposed? Point blank, what is it? And oftentimes if it's curable, you'll hear that it's XYZ with surgery or surgery and radiation. If it's true, if a patient were to have true invasive cancer, so remember breast cancer, some people use stage zero, which is ductal carcinoma in situ. So it's like it's a cancer, but it's not invasive. That's why it's just stage zero. There is literature coming out suggesting we're over aggressive with that, but it's a stage zero. Anything stage one and above is true invasive breast cancer. And let me just give you one example. Survivals were very bad, and you cried if you had something called HER2 positive. That's a protein that's on a breast cancer that has nothing to do with hormone. That was very aggressive, and survivals were terrible, especially when we did surgery up front. Then we designed a drug that we had nothing to do with it, and it's a whole different industry. But you design a drug that can hone in on that HER2, the same thing that made it so aggressive, and it hones in, latches, and injects chemotherapy into that cell to kill it. Now, when you have a HER2 positive or expressing what was a very aggressive breast cancer, and still is, unless you treat it, now anyone stage two or three, for the most part, we give a treatment to do that before we take it out. Because when you take it out, you can't do any treatments. We know that if it's less than 200 million or less than 100 million, that you could have disease that we can't see. That's the whole reason we recommend chemo sometimes after or radiation. We know how many we need to see it on a CT scan. And we know that these things come back to X percent. We know 20% come back, 30% come back. Then we test something to see, okay, does doing this make this percentage that comes back less? And if the answer is yes, then we say it has a statistical benefit. But in the case of this HER2, I'm telling you, like, to forego something if it's HER2 positive for a very aggressive tumor, like, it, you know, there's a vulnerability there just because we know how terrible HER2 is forever, and now we can attack it. So that's where that's why I'm writing my book that says it's time to cancel the cure, cancel the term a cure for cancer. There's not a blanket statement or strategy to even the same, like even within breast cancer, there's like three different receptor statuses and all this stuff. Everything is different, markedly different. So if I could give you one piece of advice, ask your oncologist, first of all, see the oncologist, ask him all the questions, him or her, and say, how is mine different than the other types of this cancer? How is my breast cancer different than other breast cancers? Like, is it atypical? What is it expressed? How is my colorectal cancer different? What makes it worse or better? So now you've at least kind of identified or refined what type you have specifically before you go follow something that's more of a blanket for the whole tumor. And then you ask those statistic questions. And I think there is where you find, and you pray on it, look inward, whatever the term, you know, is and what you believe, then figure out what you feel good about and go that way.
Got it. Final question for you. It's going to get a little bit more, I guess, futuristic, I guess you could say. When you look at the recent advancements or look back from a decade or two decades ago and look at how the oncology industry has changed in terms of advancements and what cancer can now be cured that wasn't able to cure before, when you look forward in 30, 50 years and see these tests or studies that are happening with CRISPR and gene editing, all these different things that are potentially going to be helpful for us. Like, where do you envision the future of certain cancers that can be cured? Can all cancers can be cured? Like, what are some of the technologies that are going to be coming out, you think?
Love this question. So I've never been asked it. But without making it take forever, there's a couple of things that will make that happen. Number one, we already said it, find it early enough, right? So if it's taking 100 million, then I'm sure people have listened to this and been like, bro, you keep saying that. How come we can't find it sooner? That's what they're looking at. They're looking at to see what are the pieces of food or at what rate of food eating do cancers do that are different than your regular cells. So they're basically like isotyping it or putting some kind of tracker. So now you can go see attack metabolically. You can take advantage of the fact that we know cancers are aggressive, hungry, high energy, eating, consuming. That's why people lose weight with a lot of cancer. We know that they're eating at a whole different rate. Like if you didn't like meatheads, quote unquote is the term, I don't mean to be insensitive, and you just poisoned a whole bunch of protein shakes and creatine, it's like not all of us will be like affected, right? Like how many people drink creatine before workouts if they're in the gym? But all the people that, you know, need the creatine for the gym, you've selected for a population that is unique for a reason, right? So the same concept applies to cancer cells. If you could attack something with what they're eating and consuming, because we know they're consuming it differently than our regular cells, the whole, I don't want to call it a game, but the whole thing, the whole script changes. The second thing is, what if based on that activity, you were able to like see it much sooner, like in a cell of 10 or 20 or 30 or 100, you just see that faint light up or use some crazy technology because you can just see it a lot sooner rather than just glorified pictures. That's what MRI and CTs are. They're just pictures.
Right.
Well, why aren't we like figuring out what they're consuming to make it like more obvious? So detect them earlier, take advantage of the fact that they eat different things. And the third thing is, and you might have heard of this, and I'm going to say the V word, which is a vaccine, but the way that vaccines work or are, and it, I don't know if it'll cure all cancers, but that same HER2 receptor I told you about, and you mentioned CRISPR, if you coded the same way that we did for COVID, we coded like, not we, because I have nothing to do with it, by the way, or vaccines, different, no opinion. But we coded basically the M protein. So I talked about HER2, but we coded an M protein, not to the virus, put in the body so that the lymphocytes got smart, recognized it, and so something comes in with an M protein that kills it. What if you had the same concept about the HER2 receptor, like in a way that's like cancer aligned? You code it, or you go ahead and code something to say when that HER2, on cell number one, so patient zero, but instead of cancer zero, cell, your body immediately just neutralizes it. Boom, dead, done. Like that is the concept, because these cancers, at least to some degree, Jason Fung disagrees a little bit, and I agree with the fact that he disagrees, but this is how it is right now, is that like whatever those tools are, if your body is equipped to kill it, your immune system's not going to be outsmarted, then boom, then all of a sudden you reduce cancer rates hugely. So catch it sooner, take advantage of the fact that it eats differently, and be equipped to really make your immune system like Marines rather than, you know, whatever is less than that.
And are most of these already in advancements, like particularly the things that you mentioned around imaging, where you can detect it before 100 million? These are all things that are coming up and potentially in the next, 5-10 years, you think?
They're definitely looking at all these things now. The annoying thing is, and the tragic is, you have to, and need it, I guess, but you have to prove it. And to prove it, it's very expensive. You have to prove that it shows a survival difference. And then how can you show a survival difference if people are living years with cancer without having years of the study once the technology is made? So it's a very long process, and it's very expensive to coordinate, you know. So that's what's tragic. That's what gets me IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, every day. Just knowing what's out there, people are dying, there are tools out there that like people could potentially be using, but it's never going to be paid for because it's not proven to show overall survival, but it makes sense in theory. That's the whole concept of evidence-based. We have to be, I guess, you know, there's no better option. You have to be evidence-based, and yet there's all these things out there. And I don't know, that's some of my podcasts. I learned about them, and then I'm telling when my close friend has cancer, I'm always like, well, we should try this. And it's hard. It's a slippery slope. But it's like, I think it's something we all grow together. We just have to be less, you know, divided and compartmentalized. The healthcare system's like that too. It's like this pharma here, this academics here, this community here, there's drug development, and they're just all got their own pathways. And I think anything separated that deviates from community is it's just counterproductive, and it applies societally, you know, medically, everything.
Yeah, it seems like even with this imaging thing, if someone literally has no options. I don't know what the downsides of using this thing are, but it seems like it's more political, if anything, around this rather than mitigating the downsides of what it could actually do.
Yeah. How do you scale it? That's the issue. How do you scale it? And yeah. There's some truth to, you know, naivete is bliss. It's true. All that stuff you hear, right, about like the more you learn, the harder, you know, it's just so true. But it's like, I'm just waiting for the next step to like somehow be okay with it and figure out. Right now, I'm just like, we got to fix it. We got to do this. We got to do that. And it's distressing. But the more we share and collaborate, the faster those things can happen. That's what I keep telling myself. You just got to share stuff like this and just, you know, and work on a goal together. That's how you get there quicker.
A philosophical one for you, but maybe controversial as well. But do you think there's a chance that cancer will never be cured just because of how much money is in pharmacology?
I do not. I do not. It's such a difficult. Well, I mean, let me back up. Would it be devastating to cure cancer overnight economically? Yes, right? I mean, like, people think that doctors or whatever are making like that. The people that benefit from cancer treatment are in a whole different world. Like, doctors and patients and staff and ER nurses and all these people you hear about, we're all in one same tier. The people that make the money are the PBMs, the people that decide the drug pricing, the pharma, the insurance companies. We're talking astronomically the high numbers, right? Mm. And yes, there's a significant amount of federal and state like taxing that comes out of that. So can I say that do I believe in any part of my being that right now we haven't cured cancers because of that, like that reality? No, I don't think they're not mutually exclusive. It's true, being debilitating and cured overnight. But that's the whole point of my book. It's time to cancel the term a cure for cancer. And all I mean by that is there's a bunch of cures for a bunch of cancers that can be conceived, but not one cure for all cancers, because they're all, like I told you, behave like there's three different kinds of, you know, breast cancer. But we cure cancer. I mean, we cure cancers all the time. We cure leukemia, which is a terrible cancer. Testicular, we cure, and we cure it so well, even if it's spread, it's still not stage four. We still call it stage three because we're so good at it with the chemotherapy, right? So there's and melanoma, we're super excited about, and renal cell, something you just got published this summer, we are able to maybe suggest that we cure kidney cancer and melanoma based on the survivals we're seeing with immune therapy, dual immune therapy. So when you see these things, you're like, well, clearly, why are they, like, we're not trying to hide it. We get really excited when it happens. And we are curing, especially blood cancers, all the time. And CAR-T seems, you know, a better shot at curative in blood cancers than anything else. So I think that question is definitely more relevant 3 or 5 years ago. But now it's almost inarguable when you're looking to see where we've gotten, like how we could say like, oh, they're avoiding it, because it's actually part of the conversation now for tumors we didn't think we could cure before.
Yeah. So you think it's kind of like Reddit world when people are talking about that there are cures for certain types of cancers that exist but are just not being put out because of the money that is in pharmacology. You think everything that's been cured has been out and available for the public.
And we're doing it. And I told you, I mean, it takes years to be able to find it. So if you like to prove that it's like to get it funded. So like, how would we have had that technology 10 years ago? When you look at the tech of what we have cured, you're like, whoa, we all came up with that in 2015. And it's like, finally, we can say it's being cured. So when you tease it down like that, you're like, okay, it's more acceptable that it's probably not being hidden, just because then you look at it and you see like, oh yeah, that tech is super not something we had in 2010. They're saying they cured it now. How could they have proven that sooner, you know? But that doesn't mean, that's what I learned with social media, with a lot of things especially. That doesn't mean that it's not true that if cancer was cured overnight, that the United States wouldn't be wrecked. That's true, but it's just irrelevant because that's just not possible. Like, is like to be all of it at once. Like, it's just not, it's impossible. Yeah. And that's why we're slowly curing them, like different cancers. But there's just so many.
Right.
I don't think we're slow playing it either, if that's your next question.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole rabbit hole that we can go into just around what's happening in that world. But I really appreciate all the insights and the transparency you've shared with us. And I want to make sure that people can find you, because, I mean, the information that you have on TikTok, as we were talking offline, is a really great combination of like using humor, entertainment, but also really valuable information coming from a very valid source, where literally before our talk, you were in the ER, like you're in the action, man. So it's really grateful to have someone like yourself that's in the arena, that's really in the front lines of doing work. I think you mentioned that you're also going to the White House sometimes to promote certain potential bills that are going to be coming along. So where can people find you online and where can people learn more about you?
Yeah. So my handle pretty much across everything is the Onc Doc. Onc stands for oncology, O-N-C. So it's the O-N-C-D-O-C doc. And then my podcast, if you like this nerdy stuff, is Target Cancer Podcast. And it's on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, et cetera. I mean, between those two, I think you can capture most of it. I have a website, S. Janaja. It's my last name, initial, md.com, but it's a pretty poor website. I need to work on it.
And when's the book coming out?
We got a ways to go, but I, without saying too much, I'm in conversation with Jason Fung, and we've been chatting back and forth about maybe coming up maybe with a different angle. So I might have a pivot here with him. So we'll see.
Okay. All right. Maybe we'll do a trio podcast when the book is out.
There we go. That would be awesome.
Love it. Love it. All right. Well, thanks so much for tuning in, guys. And Dr. Sanjay, I appreciate you for coming on.
Of course. Thank you so much, Sean.